Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is Bill Gates. He is known principally for three things: Microsoft, making money, and now giving vast sums of it away. The first part of his life saw him found, build and run a software company so successful it's made him the richest person on earth. Now he's turned his formidable drive and intellect to funding and running the world's largest independent charitable foundation, with the simply stated aim of dramatically improving the quality of life of billions of people. All this from the world's most celebrated college dropout. His father says his son has never done things by halves. Aged 11, he was a boy who appeared to gain the intellect of an adult almost overnight, reading anything he could get his hands on, including a full set of encyclopedias cover to cover. 40 years ago, his early ability to work on code, the very architecture of computer technology, and to so readily grasp its profound implications, has indelibly shaped both his life and ours. He says, "It's pretty amazing to go from a world where computers were unheard of and very complex to where they're a tool of everyday life. That was the dream that I wanted to make come true, and in large part it's unfolded as I expected." So, Bill Gates, welcome to Desert Island Discs. In this fast-moving digital age, I think it would be fair to say that time is pretty much our most precious commodity, and I have it on good authority that your life and your appointments are timed in one-minute slots. Am I right about that?
Well, I'm very busy, but no, I don't do one-minute meetings, and I do leave a lot of time so I can read and think about things.
In 2014, then, you stepped down, of course, as chairman of the board of Microsoft, the company that you had co-founded back in the mid-70s. Over the last year and a bit, how much has your life changed?
Well, the big transition was in 2008, where I went from being full-time at Microsoft and part-time at the foundation to the other way around. My primary passion, all my travel, most of my reading is about the work of our foundation, which I do together with my wife.
I suppose I'm wondering if there is a part of your heart, though, that is always in technological innovation. I mean, are there things happening in that world that you're no longer full-time in that really excite you right now?
The digital revolution, which keeps moving at an incredible pace, not only do I try and stay up on that, it's also part of how we're going to lift up the lives of poor people, like doing digital banking on phones. That's my original career, but now applied not just to people willing to pay for software, but for those in the world who are worst off.
You've already mentioned today, I think, two or three times, reading. These days, what piques your interest? How much do you read?
I try and read a book most weeks. I read The Economist cover to cover. I get lots of friends sending me book ideas and articles. I also watch a lot of lectures. There's a company that, whether it's science or history or economics, get the best professors and record their lectures. So often when I'm flying around, I'm watching those DVDs.
Bill Gates, I don't know how much you know about our little island here that we're going to cast you away to, but of course you're going to be all alone. How does that prospect suit you?
Well, I'd be disappointed because first, you know, the time to read and think and write stuff would be great. But then say I have an idea about malaria eradication. Do I get to tell somebody? Do I get to go out and actually go do it? So I wouldn't be long before I'd be trying to get off the island.
Okay, we're going to go to your music then. Let's hear about the first one.
This is David Bowie and Queen doing Under Pressure. In my 20s and 30s, I worked a lot, but a few Fridays and Saturdays we'd go out and dance. So this kind of reminds me of those disco days with a little bit of weekend freedom.
Let's go.
Under Pressure, David Bowie and Queen. So the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has to date spent $34 billion on projects in around about, I think, 100 countries. Of the many areas that it works in, which are the ones that really grab you, that sort of set you alight?
Well, a big thing for us is getting rid of the diseases that kill children under five. And over the last 25 years, we've gone from having 12 million children a year die to now less than 6 million a year. And we'd like to cut that in half again in the next 15 years. So that means we've got to go take malaria, which is still killing over 600,000 kids a year. We have to get rid of it.
And your approach when you started, am I right in saying that you looked at the world map and you wondered where you could most effectively spend money in projects where we knew how to cure things, it just wasn't being done, either because governments didn't have a mind to do it or didn't have the cash to do it?
Yeah, I knew that the wealth I had from Microsoft, Melinda and I wanted to give it back in the most impactful way. And so after a trip to Africa, we really started learning about disease, which I hadn't known a lot about. I was, you know, so focused on computers and all the miracle there. And we were stunned to realize that for each $1,000 we gave, if we did it the right way, we could save a life.
You say we wanted to give it back, all this money that you had made. Why did you want to give it back?
Well, you don't have many choices. I mean, you're not going to spend it on yourself. And we think only a small portion should go to our kids so that they can have their own careers and make their own way. And so that leaves most of it for Melinda and I to work on. How should it be spent for the most needy in the world?
Combating malaria, HIV, AIDS and polio have been three of the areas of concerted effort for your foundation. I imagine visiting the projects in the field, the human suffering you see firsthand must be enormous.
When you see the cost of the diseases or even the malnutrition where the kids who survive don't grow up to achieve their full potential, it does bother you that there's not more generosity or there's not more creativity, that we're not drawing in the best scientists. Of course, you not only see how tough it is, but you also see the improvement. I was just in Nigeria last week, and everyone thought we'd never get rid of polio there. Now we've gone 18 months without a single case, not only in Nigeria, but all of Africa. We're down to just Pakistan and Afghanistan as the only countries with any polio. So we're hopefully very close to making it the second disease ever after smallpox that has been completely eradicated.
Time for some more music, Bill Gates. Tell me about our second then.
Well, my wife Melinda and I love Willie Nelson, and so as a surprise gift for her, I had him show up the night before we got married. We were on a beach in Hawaii, and he kind of walked down the beach with his guitar, and I said, here he is, let's have this guy sing some songs for us. And it was kind of dark. It wasn't until he kind of got up on the stage and started singing that everybody realized, oh, Willie Nelson had come to sing. And, you know, one of our favorite songs is this one.
Blue skies smiling at me. Nothing but blue skies do I see. Blue birds singing a song. Nothing but blue skies from now on. I never saw the sun shining so bright. Never saw things going so right. Noticing the days hurrying by. When you're in love, my, how they fly by. Blue days.
Memories of the night before your wedding, Bill Gates. That was Willie Nelson singing Blue Skies. So you were born into a family, it has to be said, with a pretty distinguished pedigree in business, politics, community service. Your great-grandfather had been a state legislator and mayor. Your grandfather was the vice president of a national bank, and your father was a successful, prominent lawyer. What was he like as a dad when you were a little boy?
My dad was pretty busy. He'd go early in the morning off to work, come back at dinner time. My mom did a lot of the family stuff, but at dinner we would talk about my dad's lawsuits. And so my older sister and I got an exposure to the world from a pretty young age. And our grandmothers both were big readers, and so they both read to us and brought us reading a lot of books.
Is it true that your mother's nickname was Giggles?
Yes, apparently when she was young, they called her that. She was very energetic, wanted to make sure we were serious about our work and did our chores.
I read also that she was intensely competitive. Is that true?
We did a lot of family games. I learned a lot of different card games. And when we had people over to the house, we would do different games. Outdoors, things like capture the flag, volleyball, charades.
And your mother started off as a teacher. She sounds to me like somebody who was very highly socially engaged. You know, she wanted to be out there in the community doing her thing. Did she bring that to the dinner table?
Right. So she, as women were more drawn in to different activities, first she did volunteer things. Eventually she went on to some corporate boards. So she also, along with my dad, had lots of interesting things like United Way is a charitable organization. Planned Parenthood, volunteering.
Planned Parenthood, that would have been quite controversial. I mean, it still is controversial in parts of America.
That's right. But my parents were both big believers in it. My dad was the head of that. So they set a very good example of being engaged in giving back.
Your father said of you when you were a little boy, you know, that often he would be kind of shouting up the stairs, "Bell, it's time to go." And he would say, "What are you doing?" And you would say, "I'm thinking." As a little boy, you know, did it feel busy in your head?
Well, there were a lot of mysteries about how things worked, you know, why some people succeeded, other people didn't. I read tons of biographies of people to get a sense of different careers.
Did you have a sense quite young that success was important?
I knew I wanted to work on hard problems. So something like being a lawyer looked interesting, but being a scientist looked even more interesting. And then the computer came along and kind of surprised me, as none of those biographies I read had people been involved in computers, because that was completely new. And so it answered my question of what I was going to work on. So, you know, all that worrying about it, thinking about it, you know, the solution appeared magically.
More of that to come, of course. For now, let's listen to your third choice. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Well, my kids, who are 19, 16 and 13, refresh my musical taste by tuning the radio or calling up songs on their phones. And so this is one that my 13-year-old Phoebe happens to like. Ed Sheeran has lots of good songs, but we picked this one to sing. I need you, darling, come on, set the tone. If you feel the falling, won't you let me know? Oh, oh, oh. If you love me, come on, get involved. Feel it rushing through you from your head to toe.
That was Ed Sheeran and Sing. Just as we were going into that, Bill Gates, you said that computers came along and solved the problem of what this young boy was going to engage his very active, able brain with. I had read that although you were brought up in this very nurturing and loving home, when you were 12, your parents were worried about you. I mean, they were worried enough to send you to a child psychologist. What was the problem?
I was a bit disruptive. I started early on sort of questioning, were there rules logical and always to be followed? So there's a tiny bit of tension there as I was kind of pushing back. And the person they sent me to was very nice and, you know, got me reading a lot about psychology and Freud and stuff like that. And he'd convinced me that you know, it was kind of an unfair thing that I would challenge my parents, and I really wasn't proving anything. So by the time I was 14, I got over that, which is good, because then they were very supportive as I started to really engage in writing software and learning different computer things.
You were around about, as you say, 14 when Lakeside School got a computer. Tell me, please, about the first time that little Bill Gates met a computer.
The teachers found it very baffling. And so there were a few of us who were very good at math and just sat around there playing with the thing, ended up, you know, figuring it out. They even had us teach programming to some of the other kids as well. And then companies eventually came and said, "Hey, come and help us with some software problems."
And so Paul Allen, who was a couple of years ahead of you at Lakeside School and would, of course, become you're a co-founder of Microsoft. Is it true that both of you worked out a way of manipulating the school software in order that you were the only two boys in classes full of girls?
Yeah, Paul did the computer scheduling with me. Unfortunately for him, he was 2 years ahead of me, but he was off at college by then. So I was the one who benefited by being able to have the nice girls at least sit near me. It wasn't that I could talk to them or anything, but they were there. I think I was particularly inept at talking to girls or thinking about, okay, do you ask them out? Do you not?
Did you pluck up the courage?
A little bit, but not much. Then when I went off to Harvard, then I was a little bit more sociable, but I was below average on talking to girls.
Between the ages of 13 and 16, typically how many hours a day do you think you were spending programming and working it out with a computer?
Yeah, I got pretty obsessed, skipping gym class and going over to the computer center at nights a lot. You know, I spent at least 4 or 5 hours a day working on programming things. It was my big thing, and my grades weren't suffering because of it.
When you were engaging in it at that age, did you feel like somebody with a kind of great privileged secret?
Absolutely. And then at one point, Paul found the magazine that showed that they were putting computers, which were gigantic, putting them all onto a chip, which was called the microprocessor, and that every couple of years it would double in power. And so when Paul showed me that, we realized not only did we have this magic world that we were having fun with, but that it was going to explode and change everything.
I want to know all about that in just a second, but tell me about this. We're going to listen to your fourth.
Well, Paul Allen was far more into music than I was. And the musician that he loved the most was Jimi Hendrix. And because I was younger, he would sometimes taunt me with the title of this song, Are You Experienced? Because I, you know, hadn't gotten drunk or other various things. So this is one of our favorites.
But first, are you experienced? Or have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. Well, I know. You probably scream and cry that your little world won't let you go. But who in your measly little world are you trying to prove that you're made out of gold and a...
Jimi Hendrix and Are You Experienced? The company Microsoft, the Windows operating systems, the subsequent Gates Foundation... Maybe none of them would have existed if it hadn't been for Paul Allen's discovery of this little kit computer. It was on the front of what they called then the Hobbyist magazine, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, Paul had seen that the microprocessor was coming, but then in December 1974, Paul got the magazine, brought it to me, and said the thing that we had talked about was starting to happen, and it might happen without us, so we needed to call up that company and go down there and help them write software. In fact, they were pretty naive about software, so they were actually quite enthused when we said we had software for the machine. So I left Harvard at that time.
And you were 19.
And we started Microsoft.
When you said to your parents, Mom and Dad, I'm leaving Harvard, how did that conversation go?
Well, it went better than you might think, because if the company had failed, it's not like Harvard wouldn't have taken me back. And they knew that I loved college. It was only that this one thing seemed like it was happening. We wanted to be at the center of it and really drive it forward. It was even more exciting than college. So they saw it as, you know, some side thing that maybe had a low probability of working out, but that it wouldn't damage me.
And so Microsoft, I think it had a hyphen when you began the company. How did you start it?
Well, Paul and I had done enough programming things, including our high school scheduling, that we'd saved some money. So we just funded it ourselves and had enough to hire a few people. The company with the kit computer was our first customer, so we licensed the software to them. And then many other companies came along to make these personal computers. So in 1975, we write the BASIC. By 1977, you've got Apple Computer with the Apple II, Commodore, Radio Shack, a number of machines coming out. almost all based on our software.
And this sort of frantic feeling, just briefly, that you say you had, we've got to start this because other people are going to get there if we don't. Actually, that was vital to the company's success.
Yeah, being first helped a lot. I mean, we got to make a lot of mistakes because it was all new. You know, how do you go do business in Japan? You know, I'm hiring people who are older than me. I can't even rent a car because I'm not 21 years old. So it was really frantic.
You did drive without a license, didn't you?
I lost my license at one point because I sped a little too much. I'm well over that. But back then, my first car was a Porsche 911. One of my few indulgences was that at night, to think about our strategy, I'd go out and drive my Porsche up in the hills.
How old are you?
19.
I don't even want to think about the insurance on that. Let's go to your next piece of music then. We're on your fifth.
As the foundation was getting going around 2000, Paul told me that I should meet Bono. And I didn't prioritize it because I thought a musician isn't going to really understand this global health stuff. But we finally did get to meet, and I was amazed at how he had thought about it, read about it. And so it started a partnership, and he's been absolutely amazing.
Will it make it easier on you now? You got someone to blame. You're saying one love, one life, when it's one need in the night. One love, we get to share.
That was U2 and One. So, Bill Gates, by 1979, you were running Microsoft. The company was grossing around about $2.5 million. You were only 23. In those first, let's say, 10 years of building Microsoft, what was going on in the rest of your life?
I was quite fanatical about work. I worked weekends. I didn't really believe in vacations.
If the boss doesn't believe in taking vacations, then sure as hell the people under him shouldn't be taking any vacations. You've got a very broad smile on your face. Did you find that, you know, you had to drag people along with you, or were they all as equally invested as you?
No, I had to be a little careful not to try and apply my standards to how hard they worked. You know, I knew everybody's license plate, so I could look out in the parking lot and see, you know, when did people come in, when were they leaving. Now, eventually I had to loosen up as the company got to a reasonable size.
I want to just spool forward a little bit. The operating system Windows 95 sold around about 40 million copies in its first year, so a huge success. With success came this string, and very well-documented string, of Federal Trade Commission, U.S. Justice Department investigations into alleged unfair marketing and so on and so on. Ruthless was a word that was very often used to describe your business practices. And of course, the concern was that this company was so phenomenally successful that it would end up being a monopoly, and a monopoly is not healthy. Would you say you were ruthless in business?
No. Only if you define having super low prices as ruthless. It's hard to compete with somebody who's betting on the volume and saying, hey, we're going to have share by having these super low prices. That's very intimidating. And in that sense, yes, we were aggressive.
Let's talk for a moment about the relationship between you and the late Steve Jobs of Apple. It is one that has fascinated business commentators and people in the tech world for so many years. Can you tell me about your relationship with him in the early days?
Well, Steve really is a singular person in the history of personal computing in terms of what he built at Apple. And for some periods, we're complete allies working together. I wrote software for the original Apple II. Sometimes he'd be very tough on you. Sometimes he'd be very encouraging. And he got really great work out of people.
He died, of course, in 2011, just 56 years old. As I understand it, you saw him a few months before he died. When you spoke to him, what did the two of you speak about?
Well, in the early years, the intensity had always been about the project. And so then as Steve got sick, it was far more mellow in terms of talking about our lives and our kids. In fact, he and I gave a joint interview together. You know, I talked about how I envied his incredible design skills. Steve was an incredible genius, and I was more of an engineer than he was. But anyway, it was fun that it was more of a friendship that was reflective. although tragically then he couldn't overcome the cancer and died.
And so tell me then about this next piece of music.
When we did the interview, Steve was really into music. You know, he loved the Beatles and so did I. And he actually mentioned this song, The Two of Us, saying that was kind of like this journey we'd been on where we'd been competing and working together, that, you know, only we understood how intense and what great memories came out of that.
The Beatles and Two of Us for memories of your, can I call him your good friend?
Was absolutely.
Steve Jobs your good friend?
Absolutely.
So, Bill Gates, you've been married to Melinda since 1994. Can you remember the very first time you met her?
Yeah, we were, there was a Microsoft meeting in New York, and I was the second to last one to come, and I sat down, and she was the last one to come. She sat down next to me. And I asked her if she wanted to go out dancing that night, and she had some other people she was going off with. So then a few weeks later, I saw her in the parking lot, and I said, hey, could you go out in a couple weeks? And she said, well, that wasn't spontaneous enough for her.
Goodness knows how many magazines listed you as the world's most eligible bachelor. Was she slightly giving you the runaround? Was she slightly making
neither of us started out thinking that it would turn into, I was still being fanatical. But then after the first big trip we went on, we watched the videotape of The Sound of Music, which we both loved. And that's when it really started to get kind of serious, because on that trip, we talked a lot about our dreams for the future.
Do you think she ever had doubts that she could deal with you and the way you lived your life? I mean, it sounds like such an extreme life of such devotion to business.
Well, she changed that, and I wanted her to change it. I was willing in my 20s and most of my 30s to say the job was the center of my life, and therefore I wasn't going to get married or have kids. But I knew that eventually I wanted to, and she arrived at kind of the perfect time, and you know, we fell in love, and I had to think about it a little bit. And I said, yeah, I want to change my priorities. And, you know, now we actually take quite a few vacations. I'm sure myself in my 20s would look at my schedule now and find it very wimpy indeed.
And so aside from family life, you have set up the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And along with all the work you do, of course, comes a huge amount of attention. You will be aware, I'm sure, very recently of the Campaign for Global Justice criticising your organisation because they say they are worried that the foundation's relationship with big business, with pharmaceuticals, with the promotion of genetically modified crops is not in the best interests of some communities. Personally, what do you make of that sort of criticism?
Well, it's important that big institutions be subject to criticism. I want the foundation to do the best job possible. There are some things like we believe in giving women contraception and the use of science, including GMO seeds. We think that's very important because we're trying to stop malnutrition and that the safety's been proven. But, you know, the criticism is important because we're out there working on big, big issues. And to whom much is given, much is expected. That's something that my mom, who died just a year after we got married, said to us on the day we were married.
Let's have some more music, Bill Gates. We're now on your seventh. Tell me about this.
I mentioned Melinda and I both loved The Sound of Music. And later, as I met Warren Buffett, another amazing person, he and his first wife, Susie, sang a song from The Sound of Music. And in fact, this is one we'd never heard of because it was in the Broadway musical and not in the movie, and it's kind of a cute song. So Melinda and I think of this as one of our favorites. It's called How Can Love Survive?
No rides for us on the top of a bus in the face of the freezing breezes.
You read your goals in your comfy old Rolls or in one of your Mercedeses.
Far, very far off the beam are we, quaint and bizarre as a team are we, 2 millionaires with a dream are we, we're keeping romance alive. 2 millionaires with a dream are we, we'll make our
Can Love Survive, from the Broadway version of Rodgers and Hammerstein's The Sound of Music, sung there by Kurt Katzner and Marion Marlowe. Bill Gates, the tag of the richest man in the world, reputed net worth $79 billion. You give huge amounts of your personal wealth away. Do you have a guilty pleasure?
Well, you know, I buy all the books that I want, but that's not a lot of money.
Oh, come on.
I'd say that being able to fly in my own plane is the most guilty thing I do, but it allows me to get out to Africa and to Asia, travel a lot more than I would otherwise. It's a real luxury.
The famed industrialist and philanthropist Andrew Carnegie once said, "Whatever I engage in, I must push inordinately." Something about that reminded me of you. Have you ever wondered why you are the way you are? Why it is that when you do something, you have to do it the way you do it, which is to the nth degree?
Oh, a little bit, sure.
And what have you come up with?
I think if you're in science, you learn to be good at being self-critical and questioning your assumptions. And, you know, I've always thought being intense about things is kind of a young, fun, energetic way to go about things. You know, and I hope in the decades ahead as we're, you know, trying to do these ambitious goals, I keep that kind of intensity. You know, I can't answer exactly why I'm a little more intense than other people. I'm no more intense than Steve Jobs was, I'll say that.
Well, that's quite the comparison. Let's have your eighth disc of the morning then. What's the final one?
Well, I love plays, including musicals, and one of absolutely the best I've ever seen is this Hamilton that's now on Broadway. And this is one of many great songs from it, but it's about a young person saying, hey, I'm going to take a risk. I'm going to get out there and try and do something new and different. So this song in particular appeals to me. It's called My Shot.
I am not throwing away my shot. I am not throwing away my shot. Hey, yo, I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry, and I'm not throwing away my shot. I'm going to get a scholarship to King's College. I probably shouldn't brag, but dag, I'm amazed and astonished. The problem is I got a lot of brains, but no polish. I gotta holler just to be heard with every word. I drop knowledge. I'm a diamond in the rough, a shiny piece of coal, trying to reach my goal. My power of speech, unimpeachable. Only 19, but my mind is older. These New York City streets get colder. I shoulder every word.
That was My Shot from the musical Hamilton, composed by Lin-Manuel Miranda and sung by members of the original Broadway cast. So it's time now, Bill Gates, to do what I do with all my castaways, which is I give you a couple of books. You get the Bible and you get the complete works of Shakespeare to take to this island. And you also get to take a book of your own. What book would you like to take along?
Well, my favorite book is by Steven Pinker, and it's called The Better Angels of Our Nature. And it's a brilliant discussion of how humanity's treating humanity better, less deaths, less slavery over time. I'm always telling people to read the book, but it's very long. So on the desert island, I guess I'll get to read it many times.
Okay, you get to take your copy of that then. And we allow everybody a luxury. What will your luxury be?
Well, I suppose asking for an internet connection is probably outside the rules.
That breaches every possible rule.
Okay, you know, I love these lectures. So I'd load up a whole bunch of DVDs of all the world's great lectures.
We shall give you that then. And if you had to save just one of these eight carefully chosen tracks from the waves, which one would it be?
Well, because of the central role Melinda and our marriage has and all the great things going on, I'd pick the Blue Skies, the Willie Nelson song.
It's yours. Bill Gates, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.